Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is September 22nd, 2003. Today's session is entitled Ethics in Politics, presented by former Illinois Senator Paul Simon, number LENS 2003-01. Let's listen in.
And he does it from the university perspective, Dr. Norm Metzler. Norm's at Concordia University in Portland. He works with what we call our affiliated learning partners here in the Northwest. He's a good friend, and he helped us get in touch with Senator Paul Simon and began the process, so I've asked Norm to introduce him to us.
Thanks, Bob. It's indeed a pleasure for me to introduce to you Senator Paul Simon. Indulge me with a bit of personal reflection, if you will, please, because of connections that do exist between Senator Simon and myself. Senator Simon was born at a very young age. And interestingly enough, in Eugene, Oregon. However, I found out on the boat on the way up that he was conceived in China and delivered in Eugene, where his dad was the pastor who was a predecessor to myself and also to Phil Shanehair at Grace Lutheran in Eugene. So when I was pastor there, from time to time, a certain senator from Illinois would stop in and needed no introduction. He just had many friends in the congregation, but would always welcome discussion and conversation with our members. So it was a neat recollection. I think many of the things that Paul has done, we've known because he's been one of the leading senators, a very prominent senator for many years in our nation, has some 55 honorary degrees, has written 19 books. Since his retirement, he has been a professor at Southern Illinois University in Carbondale, teaching in political science, history, and journalism. Also directs the Public Policy Institute at that university. And as he is here, shares his wisdom and experience with many audiences. And so without further ado, Paul, it's a joy to welcome you among us. Senator Paul Simon.
Well, I thank you very, very much, Norm, for that generous introduction. And I have to confess here, when I was a candidate in Illinois, I didn't stress my Oregon roots. Bob Winkle, we thank you for your leadership. And Kathy, wherever you are back there, we thank you. And to Chip and Sharon, my apologies for changing the schedule around. It's one of those unusual things that happened that we had to do it. And it is a pleasure, particularly. I've had bishops in the audience before and cardinals, but never bishops who can speak about anything. One of the first phrases used in the worship we just had was the phrase called to lead. And I've been given three topics here, and the first is about leadership, and I'm going to be talking about some things that some problems we face in the world of politics that are frequently not dissimilar from problems you face as pastors or in whatever field you may be. But I will this afternoon outline more of the problems, and then tonight and tomorrow morning get into more specific things that I think we can do and should do. Just in general terms, the ethical things that we ought to be doing in politics and really in any area. Number one, help others. That is a mandate we have, have the temerity to call ourselves Christians, and it just makes sense. When I speak at commencements these days, I speak at colleges and universities, but when I was first in politics, it was very small rural high schools, and one group of maybe 25, I pass out a pencil and a piece of paper, and I said, write down what you want out of life. And about half of them wrote back and said, I haven't really thought about that. But the one word I got more than any other was the word happiness. And if I could switch that to, I think, a little better term, satisfaction. And satisfaction in life comes not from adding to yourself, whether it is wealth or fame or whatever it may be. It is taking from yourself and giving to others. At Christmas, when you were 3 years old, 4 years old, you could hardly wait to see what you were going to get. And then as you matured, what gave you satisfaction really was not what you received, but what you gave. Now, there are people who never mature. and so they don't get that satisfaction, helping others. Second, be honest but not crude, and recognize you could be wrong. I hate to suggest that to theologians, but it's good to have, incidentally, the Missouri Synod here, along with the ELCA and others. But I think from time to time, you'll forgive me, Norm, some of our colleagues in the Missouri Synod need to be keeping that in mind, but it's not just Missouri Synod, it's everywhere. I remember the New York Times was doing a story about me, and the reporter came up and said, I just talked to Strom Thurmond and Jesse Helms, two senators you're always disagreeing with on the floor, and he said they both spoke highly of you. How come? And I said, well, I really don't know the answer to that. But one of the things I do is, before I get into debate, I always say to myself, this person is just as sincere as I am. And you know, it takes the edge off of things. And I think this is true not only in politics. I think it is a needed virtue, a needed ethical standard as we do church work. Every once in a while, someone comes up to me and says, Paul, I'm glad you're in politics. This is when I was still in politics. Glad you're in politics. If we just had more Christians in politics, we wouldn't have any problems. I always feel like inviting them to my next congregation. A third general principle, use time wisely. I don't think I need to expand on that. And then the fourth is have hope. And I'm going to speak primarily about helping others and the complications in the world of politics, but because the world of politics is your world also, it affects everyone here. I remember when I was in the House, we had Public Law 480, the Food for Peace program, up. And a member of the House, Republican member of the House from Colorado, very fine member, Jim Johnson, got up and had an amendment to eliminate tobacco from the Food for Peace program. How it got in there, I leave to your imagination. But I remember half a dozen of us who were strong supporters of the Food for Peace program getting together in the back of the House saying, how should we vote on this? It sounds like a very simple thing. But we also knew if we knocked out the tobacco subsidy in the Food for Peace program, we would lose the votes of most of the tobacco district members of the House. And could we pass the program? And so we, with very mixed feelings, voted for Jim Johnson's amendment. The Senate took it out. And I'm pleased to say a little later on, it has been eliminated from the Food for Peace program. But if we had been pure, so to speak, and just voted straight, we might have denied food to starving people. Gets to be complicated. I remember when we had a bill up on school lunches, and the decision was made, and I was part of it, that we would limit school lunches only to the most needy. And it sounded like it really made sense. The difficulty is when we eliminated everyone else, there were a lot of school districts where you had people who were middle-income people and maybe some upper income, not a heck of a lot, but they were no longer interested in having the school lunch program. So by eliminating a lot of people, we thought we were helping more poor people. In fact, we ended up hurting poor people and had to change the school lunch program. Welfare, complicated. And let me add, in almost every discussion of welfare, I hear racial overtones that disturb me a great deal, make me feel unhappy. We passed a bill, not with my vote, which said in any state you can be on welfare a maximum of 5 years, unless the state decided to pay for it on its own without federal assistance. But we didn't provide child care. We didn't provide jobs. We didn't provide some transportation, some basic things that particularly single mothers need if they're going to get off of welfare. I suggested, I still think is a good idea, that we have a jobs program, something like the WPA. And you know, I don't think anyone here is old enough to remember the WPA. Okay, we have two honest people in the audience. But what we did was we took the liability of unemployment and turned it into a great national asset. We had trails built in around here, I'm sure. I'm sure this area benefited from the WPA and the CCC program. We had 1.5 million Americans learned how to read and write, believe it or not, under the WPA program, probably paid enough taxes to pay, more than pay for the program by itself. We had people who learned how to become writers, including Arthur Miller and Richard Wright, both of whom have enriched our country immensely. But to move ahead, and I remember talking to President Clinton about this, and he said, that really sounds great. And then he asked that question, how much would it cost? And it would cost the first year at that point, and it would cost a little more today, $12 billion. A lot of money. But we passed a $3.5 trillion tax cut. That was the first one. And then a $450 billion tax cut. Do all of us like tax cuts? Of course. Are there higher priorities? Of course. Most things, in terms of helping others, most things have to be step by step. Once in a while, you'll find something that where you can just get a significant step ahead. But the line, I think it's from Shakespeare, one of you scholars in here can correct me on this, but who said, the best is the enemy of the good. And so we have to be careful. In a sense, that's what our fear was in the Jim Johnson Amendment on tobacco and food for peace. I was trying to recall successes that I've had that were more sweeping, just rather easily. I could only think of one, and I'm working on one that I'm going to tell you about that maybe we could have some significance on. The exception was a man contacted me who wanted to get his GED, his high school equivalency test, and get that little diploma. And it was under the local school superintendent. I called the local school superintendent where he lived, and he said, absolutely not, I'm not going to give those tests. He said, that'll encourage people to drop out of high school. And so I introduced a bill that said the county superintendent of schools would administer the test. And believe it or not, didn't get a vote against it. The next year, thousands of people in Illinois took the test. It was a great step forward. But it's the only example I can think of where something significant happened without a struggle and without having to do a step-by-step incremental approach. I'm working on something right now that maybe would interest you. One of the lessons of September 11th ought to be that we have to become more sensitive to the rest of the world. And I don't think I need to explain that. We had, last academic year, 584,000 international students in our colleges and universities. That number, incidentately, is likely to be down this academic year because of a misnamed thing called the Patriot Act, which is putting a barrier to a lot of students. I called a consular officer in China, a student who had been at Southern Illinois University, went home for the summer, wanted to come back, majoring in chemistry, and this consular officer said, Well, I don't think we ought to be teaching foreigners about chemistry in the United States. Well, I told him I think there are a few other places in the world you can learn about chemistry other than the United States. And all we do is we make enemies. Anyway, 584,000 last year, just slightly over 1% of our students ever study abroad. Back in 1976, we had the bicentennial of the country, and we had flags and bunting and speeches, but nothing to lift our vision. 2009, we're going to celebrate the bicentennial of Abraham Lincoln's birth. He is primarily known for freeing the slaves, but he was also sensitive to the international scene, and he also signed the Morrill Act, the Land Grant College Act, which was very controversial, which was the GI Bill of the 19th century. It really moved the nation ahead in higher education. What if, to celebrate his birthday, his and the anniversary, we were to say we're going to have 500,000 juniors in college who would get up to $7,000 a year to study abroad for at least a summer or a semester or a year, and with emphasis being on the developing nations. Today, 2/3 of Americans who study abroad go to Western Europe. 95% of the world's population growth in the next 50 years is going to be in the developing nations, where we're not communicating. If we did that, 500,000, in 10 years, we would have 5 million Americans who had studied abroad. We would be an infinitely more sensitive nation. Now, 500,000 times $7,000 is $3.5 billion. A lot of money, but it is 1/7 of a 1% of our federal budget. It is less than 1% of the last tax cut that we just had. The president made his speech here a couple of weeks ago talking about $87 billion more for Iraq, and Dick Cheney was on Meet the Press a week ago Sunday, saying it's going to have to be more than that. $87 billion would cover us for 15 years. And I think we'd do infinitely more for the security of our country than a lot of other things that we do. We spend more on defense than the next 26 nations combined. I'm for a strong defense. I served in the Army overseas. But I think we have to say what's really in our interest. If the president is correct, and I think he is when he said the battle is for the hearts and minds of people around the world, I think a scholarship program is going to do a lot more than one more bomber or one more submarine. Anyway, I'm working on that, but we haven't made any public announcements yet. But last week I met with Bill Frist, the majority leader of the Senate, with Dick Lugar, chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, and Ted Stevens, the head of the Appropriations Committee, and I've been meeting with some Democratic senators also. And so far there's been a cautious but warm reception to the idea, and I think it's possible. Now, it will be controversial, but almost everything that we view now as motherhood and apple pie was controversial at the time. The Marshall Plan, when it was first announced, by Harry Truman and George Marshall. First poll taken showed 14% of the American public supporting it. Overwhelmingly unpopular, because among other things, Harry Truman and George Marshall were suggesting that we help people in Germany and Japan who had just killed our brothers and fathers and sons. And, you know, there was that emotional reaction to the contrary. GI Bill. American Legion supported it. The other veterans organizations favored a bonus up to $5,000 in cash, sort of a tax cut, if you will. And it came down to a conference between the House and the Senate. This is in 1944. And the senators in the conference, when both houses pass something on the same issue, but the language differs, then you have to have a conference. And this was on veterans benefits and included the education program. The senators voted for the education program. The House members were divided 3-3. You need a majority of both houses. American Legion got on the phone to a member of the House who was not there, a congressman named Gibson from Georgia, called him and said, they met until 10 o'clock at night and said, we'll recess until 10 tomorrow morning. If somebody doesn't come up with a compromise, it's dead. They met at and right after 10 o'clock, the American Legion got a hold of Congressman Gibson, woke him up at his home down in Georgia, said, go to the Jacksonville, Florida airport, if you will. We'll charter a plane and get you back up to Washington for the conference tomorrow. Got back in Washington about 30 minutes before the conference met. We got the GI Bill, the greatest economic step forward this nation made in the last century, by one vote. The little things that we do really can make a huge difference. And we have, if we dream a little, I should have put that as part of the code of ethics. You know, one of the problems now is too many leaders are telling us we can comfortably drift into becoming a greater nation. I don't believe that. I think you have to dream and you have to sacrifice. I can't improve my home unless I'm willing to sacrifice a little. I don't believe we can improve this country or this world unless we're willing to sacrifice a little. Now, one of the other, I've kind of wandered off from my notes here. One of the other things that happens is that sometimes when you do things, you don't anticipate what the results will be, or there will be spin-offs, sometimes good, sometimes not good. I'll give you one where it was good. I got involved in statistics that the FBI keeps, strangely. It was a little boy in New York City went to catch a school bus and just disappeared. 10 years old, Eton Pates. And his father was quoted by Associated Press as saying the federal government did nothing to help. Well, I called him and I said, what did you want the federal government to do? Well, he said, among other things, he said, the FBI keeps track of missing automobiles but doesn't keep track of missing children. Well, I could hardly believe it, but I checked it out and he was right. And so I got a bill passed for the FBI to keep track of missing children and to establish a missing children's center. But anyway, so I got involved in this. I thought, you know, we really ought to keep track of hate crimes in this nation, crimes against African Americans, Jewish Americans, gay people, Asian Americans, whatever. And so I introduced the bill, and the FBI opposed it. Incidentally, they just every agency almost just routinely opposes anything that's going to give them additional work. I introduced it, and it passed and became law. And about 3 years later, the head of the FBI called me, and he said, you know, we were wrong on that hate crimes, and he said, not for the reasons that you think of. He said, we had about 400 seminars for police around the nation about the harm that prejudice does to our society. And he said, you would just be amazed at the number of police officers who really needed that and who were very grateful for this. So there was something good that happened. Well, let me tell you about something I was involved in that, where it didn't turn out that well. We had 600,000 people in our state mental hospitals around the nation. And a lot of us thought, you know, that doesn't make sense just to provide custodial help. Let's let them go, many of them, to local mental health clinics. Well, it sounded good. The only problem is, too frequently, there weren't local mental health clinics. And we had assumed they would be created. And there's a second problem. Someone with mental problems is supposed to show up at 9 o'clock on Tuesday morning, and they're just not equipped to show up at 9 o'clock on Tuesday morning. So we ended up with a lot of people on the streets and a lot of people in our prisons. Roughly, and these figures are very fuzzy, I regret to say, but roughly 18 to 25% of the people in our prisons and jails today would ordinarily be in mental hospitals. And those in our jails and prisons, two-thirds of them are receiving no help whatsoever for their mental problems. Anyway, what we proposed was well-intentioned, but we need to follow through. It didn't work out quite as we were hoping. Helping others, inevitably we get into what we do in terms of faith-based initiatives, a new phrase. The whole question of church and state is a delicate one. There is no wall of separation between church and state, a phrase that Jefferson used in a letter to some Baptists in Connecticut. If the local Methodist church is on fire, no one says, separation of church and state, we can't call the fire department. I have yet to hear any one of these purists say, let's change the name of St. Louis or St. Paul or Los Angeles. So we have not had a wall of separation. And in fact, initially, the federal government did not have an established church, but as late as 1833, we had states that still had recognized a church as the official church for that state. But there are things. How do we handle drug addicts, for example? We know that drug addicts who belong to a church or a synagogue or a mosque are more likely to be cured of that habit. How do we do that? We have helped, for example, Lutheran World Relief gets a sizable amount of help, as do the other religious groups that help overseas. How do we avoid excessive entanglement, the phrase that the United States Supreme Court uses? Not easy. where we draw the line is a struggle frequently. It's also, as we help others, we should not impose our religious views on others. Now, it's very hard to separate my background from what I believe. And so this becomes complicated, and there is a tendency to, for example, Islamic fundamentalism. We hear that phrase a lot now. I don't think the problem is Islamic fundamentalism or Christian fundamentalism or Jewish fundamentalism or Hindu fundamentalism, but it is when whatever we believe, we say, we're going to impose that on everyone else. That's the problem. And I think we have generally followed a pretty good course on that. Roman Catholic judges, for example, will grant a divorce. I had a only time I've ever debated a Supreme Court justice. I had a debate with Justice Scalia at the University of Chicago on capital punishment. I took the Catholic side on that question, and he started off saying, and this is just my personal opinion, doesn't mean how I would vote on the Supreme Court, but of course we know that's exactly how he would vote on the Supreme Court. I have a bunch of notes here, and I want to get into questions. Moral majority is an example of, I welcome the interest in politics on the part of a lot of people who weren't interested before. But I recall getting 100% bad record from moral majority one session. And one of the votes that I cast was a vote for foreign aid, for aid for hungry people. I never did quite figure out why that was immoral. But I think we have to be careful in this whole area. In the last campaign, George W. Bush, as governor of Texas, proclaimed Jesus Day in Texas, and Al Gore said he wore a bracelet that said, "What would Jesus do?" And that's what he asked himself. I talked to Brian Mulroney, the former Prime Minister of Canada, with whom I've worked on a number of things, said, "If any candidate did that in Canada, it'd just be a terrible reaction." I am not suggesting either of them was not sincere, but I think we have to be careful that we don't use religion as a tool to get votes. Well, let me touch on my other points very quickly. Be honest but not crude. Remember, you could be wrong. Don't look for perfection in yourself or in others. I hear people say, they don't want to be for this candidate or that candidate for whatever the office is because he or she is wrong on this particular issue. Well, take a look at the larger picture. Can we save it? Because I'm just about done, and then we'll get to it. Honesty means more than just not taking bribes. And here, one of the problems in politics and both political parties is the whole question of just following the polls, whatever is popular, you do. And it is a huge disservice. Let me just give you one example. We're going to have to revise Social Security. The first years of Social Security, we had 16 people working for each retiree. We are down to 3 for each retiree. and in a couple of decades, it's going to be 2.3 for each retiree. Well, you don't need to be an Einstein to figure out we're going to have to do something. And Bill Clinton, and I don't mean this as a in a partisan way, obviously, but Bill Clinton had a forum in Albuquerque and one in Kansas City, in which he said, we want to discuss what the options are, and only two options aren't on the table. One is to reduce benefits, and the other is to increase taxes. And, of course, there are only two ways of solving the problem, and you know what those two ways are. We have to face up to things, and the longer we delay that, the worse off it gets. Being honest, also, we have to face this problem of campaign financing. This morning's Seattle Times has a story on the front page, Seattle's one-year strip club freeze, now at 15 years, and it ties in the vote with some campaign contributions. One of my last days in the United States Senate, Federal Express, I have nothing against the company, Federal Express got an amendment on in conference, where in conference frequently reporters aren't there and a lot of things happen because they meet quickly to get things worked out. They got an amendment on that said that 40,000 truck drivers should be listed in, according to change the law, so 40,000 truck drivers would be in the same category as pilots for airlines. I won't go into the details, but it didn't help the truck drivers, it helped Federal Express. And then it said, and the Washington Post article said, that Federal Express contributed $1.4 million to incumbent members during that two-year cycle. And incidentally, they were about 76th among the contributors to members. Three of us tried to stop it on the floor of the Senate without success, badly outvoted. I got up in the Democratic caucus and I said, maybe this amendment has merit, but then let's hold hearings. Let's have research done. Let's find out what the facts are. But we shouldn't be caving into this special interest. And one of my senior colleagues got up and said, Paul's always talking about special interest, special interest, special interest. He said, we have to pay attention to who's buttering our bread. And that is what American politics, to much too great a degree, is about. Why can't we get health care for 43 million Americans who don't have health care coverage? Well, the people who profit by the present system are generous contributors. I have a whole list of those examples, and I'm going to stop so we can get to your question in a minute here. John Corzine, senator from New Jersey, I happen to think he's a good senator. I like him. He spent $55 million to get elected, his own money. Mike Bloomberg, don't know him at all, mayor of New York City, spent $70 million. Either one of those figures is more than the British spent in the last national election. B-2 bombers. Pentagon said they didn't want them. We got them. $1.4 billion apiece. Now, no one sent around a letter saying you're going to get campaign contributions if you vote for it. But we knew what the facts were. Anyway, use time wisely. The greatest gift each of us has, outside of health, is time. And my general impression is not too many of us use it wisely. Let me tell you, and I'm not suggesting I always use it wisely. When I was in the Senate, I had a rule, 15 minutes for an appointment, 30 minutes for a cabinet member or head of state. I use the same at SIU. Southern Illinois University, 15 minutes for an appointment. About once every 2 weeks, I will have lunch with someone. Otherwise, I work through the lunch hour. I can remember when Alan Simpson, who was a senator from Wyoming and Howard Metzenbaum from Ohio, we had three of us had lunch, and Alan said, I don't understand how you can write the books and serve on these committees with heavy responsibilities and do everything. And then Howard said, I'll tell you how he does it. Shirley and I have been trying to get Gene and Paul to come to our house for dinner, and he said, I can't do it until I finish this book I'm working on right now. Watching your time. Martin Marty, I've never asked him why he does this, but I think I know. You're invited to his home for dinner, you go at 9 o'clock at night. You know, I think he uses that extra time from 6:30 or 7 to 9 to get things done. And then those of us who go to his house, we leave when we would ordinarily leave anyway. So. Now, you have to balance things and serve your community, serve your church. But I think, let me just mention this possibility, and that is for 2 days, do a budget, a time budget on yourself, not while you're here, because this is not typical, but do a time budget. What you're doing during the day. And I think you may be surprised how much time that you can have. And sometimes combine things. I was asked to go to Albania 3 weeks ago. And I took my son and one of my grandchildren, 9 years old, along. And then we went to Greece for a few days after Albania. Well, I gave them the opportunity to see the poorest nation in Europe. And I think that was good for my 9-year-old granddaughter. But I get to spend some time. I was able to utilize that time. I limit myself to, I do a lot of international volunteer work. I limit myself to 3 trips abroad, and then I try and work in other things. We were talking about going to Concordia and Pacific Lutheran. I don't know where Rick disappeared to or if he isn't here. He's back there, sleeping in the back there. Yeah. All right. Anyway, so when I come out again, I can get work in several things. I'm 74. I don't walk as fast as I used to, but I still walk faster than most people. And if I save 3 minutes a day walking fast, I do 2 things. Number one, I'm better shaped physically. Number two, I save during the course of a year 18 hours. I can get a lot done in 18 hours. And I always, as Bob knows, I always take extra work with me just in case I get stuck in an airport or wherever I am. Finally, and I'm going to condense this one very quickly and then toss this open for 10 minutes for questions. What's the, you're the, oh, okay. Have hope. Don't be too pessimistic. Man called me the other day, and he wants a law change on teacher certification in Illinois. And I said, well, write to your state legislators, too. And he said, oh, that wouldn't do any good. And I said, well, you're certainly not doing any good not writing to them. And maybe it would do some good. Let me give you just one quick illustration. Something just happened recently. I've been doing a little work in this area of mental health in prisons, and I got a letter from a prisoner, Robert Felton Jr., in the Tams prison, Tams State Prison in Illinois. and telling about his problem. And I got a couple of letters. And over the years, I've received hundreds of letters from prisoners. And generally, you can tell when somebody's trying to give you a snow job and when they're not. And this fellow just, he really sounded like maybe there was something there. And about the same time, the wife of a retired faculty member at Southern Illinois University, Lois Hayward, contacted me. She said, I think some things are happening at the Tam State Prison that are not good, and you ought to visit it. Well, I went down there, and I talked to Robert Felton, and here's this fellow who he's reading. He's in isolation, in segregation, but he's reading Churchill and Lincoln and C.S. Lewis, things I wish my students were reading. And I said, can I do anything for you? And he said, yeah, I'd like to be able to study to take my GED and then take a test. So I came out, and there were four prison officials there. And I said to them, I said, I think he ought to be able to study to take his GED. And the woman who's a counselor there said, I agree with you. And I turned to the warden and I said, why can't he take it? And the warden said, well, we have a waiting list in Illinois prisons to study to take a GED. Well, we know statistically that prisoners who have that high school certificate are much less likely to return to prison. And so I checked to confirm that the warden was correct in what he said. And I contacted a member of the governor's staff and then talked to the state senator, Barack Obama, who's in charge of that area. I think we're going to get something done, not just for Robert Felton, but for all the prisoners who want to take GED and their exams and studies in the state of Illinois. Wouldn't have happened but for one prisoner who I'm sure a lot of other prisoners would have told him won't do any good to write that letter, or Lois Hayward writing to me. You know, the little things we do really make a difference. And let me close with a story. The Middle East is in the news every day. Most of the public news that we see is not good. But you may remember when Lebanon had its civil war, and it spilled over into Israel's northern territory. And Israel went into Lebanon, and the Palestinian leadership was in Beirut, the capital of Lebanon. And they had a choice of going to Libya, Algeria, or Tunisia. Libya and Algeria were militantly anti-Israel. And Tunisia followed a moderate course. And for whatever reason, Arafat made a decision to go to Tunisia. And after he'd been there about 6 months or 8 months, he started making some positive noises. And Senator Harry Reid of Nevada and Senator Russ Feingold of Wisconsin and I flew to Tunis to meet with him. And while we were in Tunisia, we paid a courtesy visit on the president of Tunisia. And in the course of the conversation, I said, Mr. President, I'm curious why you follow this moderate stance. Your giant neighbors are critical of you, and you have extremists in your country who are very critical of you. Why do you do it? And he said, well, we don't talk much about it. But he said, and he told about the difficulties his family had during World War II. And then he said, and a Jewish family took me in. A Jewish family took in a 12-year-old Arab Muslim boy and may have changed history. We all change history, either by what we do positively or negatively, or through our indifference, turning it over to others. I want you to change history positively. Thank you. I thank you. Now we have one question. Let me just add, I wear hearing aids. I may need some help here, Bob, on the questions. And if I may digress for a moment, most of the research in hearing is being done by the House Ear Institute in Los Angeles. They're the ones who did the cochlear ear implant for Rush Limbaugh here, you remember, about a year ago. But they tell me that if your nerve endings are not dead, they believe in 6 to 8 years, they will have drops that you can put into your ears 2 or 3 times a day, and you will have normal hearing. Be a huge help for a lot of people. Anyway, I'm not there yet. Yes.
But you said in your second point that a leader would admit being wrong. Let's say that President Bush's policy toward Iraq is found to be wrong. Could he survive politically? Could he still be a capable, respected leader if he were to go on television?
This is a matter of judgment. In my opinion, absolutely. I think if Richard Nixon had, when the Watergate thing first developed, had said, "My fellow Americans, I made a huge mistake, and I want to apologize to all of you for the mistake I made," I don't think there would have been an impeachment. If Bill Clinton had said, I'm a human being and I have done some things that I regret and I apologize to my family and to the people of America, there wouldn't have been an impeachment resolution passed in the House. Well, we're always, reluctant. One of the things that happened, incidentally, the ELCA did, that I thought was unusual. I hope some year maybe the Missouri Synod will do the same thing. You apologize for the anti-Semitic remarks and writings of Martin Luther. That's not an easy thing for people to do, to admit mistakes, even though you know it. It's sometimes hard within our own families. Yes?
I have a question concerning politics by perception. There's so much media today, much more than there has been in any decade before this. Is it possible for a politician to do politics by principle in our time anymore?
Oh, absolutely.
Absolutely.
One of the problems is the media focuses on the negative. And let me give you an illustration. I have done some work in the field of water. I sponsored some legislation, and 2 years ago, the State Department asked me to go over and meet with leaders in Syria and Jordan to get them to work with the Israelis and the Palestinians, because there has to be a regional approach. So the situation there is getting very bad. And I would love to tell you I came back and everybody agreed to work together. But 3 months ago, I was in Israel. And among other things, they had me moderate a panel of the Israeli Water Commissioner and the Palestinian Water Commissioner. And amazingly, to me and I think to the audience, the two of them agreed on just about everything. And there were 3 reporters there, and there was virtually nothing in the newspapers the next day. If they had screamed and hollered at each other, it would have been all over the newspapers. And, I think we have to keep that in mind. One of the problems in the media is We're so eager for subscribers or ratings, if you're talking about TV, that we do the sensational and distort what is happening. And then the second part, if I may be immodest, when I was running for re-election in 1990, the Roll Call, it's a publication on Capitol Hill, they had one of their columnists said, one of the sure seats for the Republicans is Paul Simon's seat, because everybody then was talking about a tax cut. We were running big deficits, and I said, we either ought to cut spending or increase taxes. And what else? Oh, capital punishment. I oppose capital punishment, and the public opinion is shifting on that one, incidentally, but still a large majority opposed to it. And I led the opposition to a constitutional amendment on burning the flag. Now, I have great respect for the flag. If you visit our home in rural southern Illinois, you'll see a flag flying there. But each year in our country, we have 2 to 4 people who burn a flag. And if we have a constitutional amendment, we'll still have 2 to 4 people who burn a flag. You know, you trivialize the Constitution. If we pass a constitutional amendment on the flag, what if somebody burns a Bible tomorrow? We're going to have another constitutional amendment? You know, but anyway, I ended up getting the biggest plurality of any candidate for governor or senator of either political party in 1990. And I always remember being in Chicago one day when my opponent was running these ads saying what a wild-eyed radical Paul Simon was. And he came up to me and he said, I think I disagree with you on every issue, but I trust you and I'm going to vote for you. The trust factor. I told one of our Democratic presidential candidates who called me the other day, I said, don't just try to pander. Tell people the truth. And in the long run, you're going to gain stature. And even if you don't, the public will benefit if you tell them the truth. Yes, Paul.
Senator Simon, I'd like to hear what your thoughts and views are on the concept of the church having a public voice and the church using the church leaders and the church in general using that voice in the public arena.
Yes, I think it has to be done carefully. the almost meaningless is to pass a resolution at your convention saying, you know, whatever it is you want to say. I can remember when we had fair housing and I was in the state legislature and the various religious bodies were passing resolutions on fair housing. But I was also hearing from their parishioners, and I was getting a very different message from those parishioners. Now, I agree with the leadership. But I think the individual standing up, a couple of illustrations. When I was in the House, I made a speech in behalf of foreign aid. And a congressman from Florida by name Dick Kelly came up to me and he said, Paul, you're absolutely right. He said, I really appreciate your speaking out like that. He said, it really is in our national interest that we have foreign aid. And he said, I only wish I could vote with you. And I said, why can't you vote with me? And he said, oh, the people in my district are opposed to it. And I said, how do you know? And he said, the mail I received. I said, how many letters have you received in the last month against foreign aid? And he said, oh, probably half a dozen. Half a dozen letters. Frightened him. Now, the interesting thing is Dick Kelly was one of those who was involved in the Abscam scandal. And you saw a video of him stuffing $100 bills into his pockets, and he went to prison. But I've often thought about it. Legally, there's a huge difference between voting against foreign aid and pocketing that bribe money. Morally, which is worse, pocketing that bribe money or voting against giving food to people who desperately need it? Anyway, now I'm wondering from your question, you're going to have to remind me of the thrust again. I got talking about Dick Kelly and the, what would
Paul, can we ask that again?
Sure.
The concept of the church having a public voice.
Oh yes.
And I ask that because the story of Philip today,
right.
The church tends to have a quiet voice.
Yeah, yes. And here, I think the leadership can stand up, and you can stand up. And the individual, this is what I was starting to say, Dick Kelly, you know, six people contacted him against foreign aid, and he's, you know, and he's frightened. The civil rights movement, I was involved in that. Religious leadership in this nation said, this is a moral issue. And they prodded our conscience. And at least some of us were galvanized. We need that, for example, poverty in our nation around the world is a moral issue. We need to be galvanized. We need people to stand up. But don't think, and I'm not opposed to a resolution, but say by the ELCA convention or Missouri Synod convention or Presbyterians or whoever. But that's not a substitute for someone in wherever you live in Washington or Oregon, I forget, you're writing to your two senators, to your House members, saying we ought to be doing something. That I literally, I've said this several times, I literally believe a letter sent to a House member or a senator saying we ought to help the impoverished around the world, one letter will save a life. If you saw someone drowning in a swimming pool and you could swim, you would jump in to save that life. A letter is infinitely easier, much less dramatic, but just as important. Thank you.
There are two settings for dinner, 5 o'clock and 6:15, and we return here at 7:30. Give Paul a break now.